Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Secrets of Meaning, the TV show and podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Aris, the director of Jewish Sacred Aging. And again, if you would like to comment and send suggestions to us or comment on something on the show, feel free to email me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. Today's edition of Secrets of Meaning, I've been looking forward to for a long time, and it is a great deal of pleasure and anticipation that we welcome to our podcast Noam Sachs-Zion, the author of this very, very interesting book, Sanctified Sex. I don't know whether you sold the movie rights yet, but this subtitle is The 2000-Year Jewish Debate on Marital Intimacy. It's a brand new book from Jewish Publication Society, JPS. And the contact information of JPS and how to get the book also, other than Amazon, will be, and bookstores will be on the chyron at the bottom. Anyway, Noam, Baruch Haba, you're coming to us from, if I'm not mistaken, Jerusalem. Ken?
From Jerusalem. If I look out my window, I can see the Dead Sea. If I look up the street, I see the largest American flag I've ever seen, which is flying over the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem.
Well, it must be from Texas. They've got the largest American flag I've ever seen in my life in Texas. Anyway, welcome. This is a fascinating book. And for my colleagues who may be listening to this or watching this, I really suggest it to you. It's a magnificent tool for teaching adult ed and even confirmation class material. So, Sanctified Sex, the 2000-year Jewish debate on marital intimacy. Very cool. Talk to me about the bedroom and Rav.
Okay. So one of the most amazing things in the Talmud, which is generally pretty reticent about sexuality, is they give us a series of visits, I would say voyeuristic visits, into the rabbis' bedrooms. Not that the rabbis are interested in being their bedrooms invaded while they're in the middle of making love with their spouses, but their students are interested. The most famous story is about a rabbi, a master called Rav, and he had a student named Kahana. And Kahana snuck underneath his teacher's bedroom, into the bedroom and under the bed. He was being Tom. Why? Because he wasn't looking. He was just listening. So he only got the audio version of what was going on above him in the bed. And when he heard that his rabbi was jesting and playing, in other words, both foreplay and conversation and a kind of gamesmanship that ultimately led to sexual satisfaction, then suddenly Kahana piped up from under the bed and saying, he called his teacher by his first name, Abba, he said, what are you getting so excited about? It's as if your mouth has never tasted a dish before. It's as if he was speaking the language that I grew up in, which is quite sexist language, that spoke about beautiful women as a dish in a positive sense. That's changed a lot 50 years later. But for Kahana, that was his way of criticizing his teacher. He said, a teacher like you, you should be concerned with reason. You shouldn't let your emotions take you away. I can understand a teenager getting excited for the first time he has sexual contact, but you're already a veteran. I came to you to learn about sanctity, and you're allowing your animal characteristics to take over. There's nothing sacred about what you were doing. And in fact, his teacher's answer was very simple. I'm not talking to you about this. It's none of your business. This is an invasion of my privacy. And in Jewish tradition, an invasion of privacy is a very serious violation. Get out of here as fast as you can. Kahana, on his way out, said, but you don't understand. I have to learn about this. This is Torah, and I have to learn. Now, I don't like Kahana at all as a person. I don't like his view that people, the older they get and the wiser they get and the more sacred they get, the less they should be involved with erotic play and with enjoying their relationship with their spouse. I totally reject that. And I certainly reject the invasion of privacy. I think Having privacy in the bedroom is what allows you to behave in a more playful way, to take on different roles, to experiment, to expose your vulnerability to somebody you trust without thinking that you're being bugged or that somebody's zooming into your bedroom and watching everything that's happening. And yet, I agree with Kahana that the only way to learn how to handle in a spiritual way and in a loving way those most intimate relations, rather than learning it from watching pornography, it's much better to learn it from a real person that you respect. And therefore, there has to be some invasion of the privacy of the people we really hold up as ideals, because Torah must be embodied, not just preached from a pulpit.
So who then would be the best teachers, Noam, to learn about this intimacy?
Right. They would have to be people who are very, very comfortable with who they are. They'd have to be people who don't think that sanctity and body are opposites. They have to be people who don't think that that are not afraid to be playful and not too serious about everything. And most important, they have to be people who really believe that the conversation between spouses in a committed relationship is a very, very high goal, and we have to work at that art. The point is that sex may be a natural instinct, but learning how to do lovemaking with dignity and with joy and with experimentation over a long period of life, that requires learning. It's a discipline. It takes work to do that, and it takes learning and opening up to various points of view to do that. And in that's it is important that we don't keep everything completely private, that we find a way to share respectfully and to listen respectfully to other people.
So, at least let me generalize, but I think it's based upon some fact. American culture, and I don't know about Israeli culture, but certainly American culture, and maybe it's from its Puritan basis hundreds of years ago. Really, I probably would have some problems with what you were talking about this openness and the sense of experimentation and pleasure and seeking pleasure. And there are plenty of passages in your book, Sanctified Sex, that really talk about in very graphic terms, seeking pleasure and how to pleasure. How come the culture still hasn't caught up with the Talmud?
Well, first of all, I don't think the Talmud is all filled with sweetness and light. The Talmud is
No,
split
but
in a debate between the followers of Rav and the followers of Kahana. That debate continues until today. But perhaps I can address the American context by talking about what motivated me to be interested in this book. And it has to do
cool.
with my own personal growth. That is the time when I was overcoming my sexual naivete, when I went to Columbia College back in 1967, was also exactly the time in which American culture, at least for those of us under 30, was undergoing the American sexual revolution. Now, at the
Yes.
same time, that sexual revolution was clearly rejecting both the more conservative views of evangelicals about virginity until marriage and talking about sex. Of course, implicitly, they were also rejecting Eastern European Orthodox halachic attitudes towards sexuality, which certainly had different origins but had so much of the same result. However, it was also a period in which American Jews, young American Jews in the Boston Chavurah, the people who wrote the Jewish Catalog, which was a bestseller of that co Jewish counterculture, it was a period in which they were struggling and deeply ambivalent about the American sexual revolution. I think that ambivalence is still with us, and that's what the book is addressing. On one side, we clearly need liberation from the guilt-generating repressiveness of a spirituality that denies the body. And that was a strong position in the Jewish counterculture. However, those people, for example, the two founders of the Boston Chavurah in 1968, that is Art Green and Reb Zalman Schachter, both of them were equally disturbed with the result of the American sexual revolution. Because as they saw it, it meant that we remove sexuality from the realm of religion and ethics, and we turn sexual needs into a natural instinct that needs to be satisfied. As long as you're doing it with consent, you can do it any way you want. But it's about you as an individual, as a selfish consumer individual, fulfilling a particular orgiastic need that you have. And therefore, religion should say nothing about it. Spirituality, the sacred, has nothing to do with it. And therefore, it really reduced it to a physiological pursuit or for the sake of physical pleasures. What both Art Green and Reb Zalman said was, that's not what we want. We believe that sexuality is the center of our sacred focus, and that in the sanctity of sexuality opens us up to the most, to the deepest form of intimacy between two human beings. And in order to do that, it has to be guided by ethical and spiritual guidance. And that ethical guidance means it's not just based on consent, it has to be based on love. And ideally, that love has to be a commitment to care the other person. Because if you want a person to open up to you and become vulnerable physically and emotionally, as you have to in sexual relations, then the greater trust you can create, an atmosphere of knowing that the other partner is not just interested in mutual pleasure, but cares about you. And of course, the most extreme form would be a commitment to marriage, where you have commitment to the overall needs of the other person for a lifelong period. If we have that trust and that commitment, then we can really achieve the maximum in sexuality and in sexual union. And that's really what's sacred. That through that, we achieve the I-thou relationship that Martin Buber talked about.
No,
so that's their dilemma.
So the subtitle of the book has to do with the Jewish debate on marital intimacy. We're seeing now a retreat from, in many surveys, a retreat from marriage as a fundamental
yes.
relationship. So can you have this idea of sanctified sex strengthening the community without the institution of marriage? Is it possible?
I certainly think it's possible, but that's a debate in the North American rabbinic world. To a large extent, the rabbinical associations and the law committees of both the conservative movement, Elliot Dorf, and the reform movement, Mark Warshawski, both took the principle that we should be educating our people not to engage in intercourse, that is full sexuality, unless there's a commitment of love in marriage. That was their view. The view of people like Art Green and Reb Zalman Schachter and Arthur Waskow, and the truth is also Irving Greenberg, who's a modern Orthodox thinker, is that you can have a committed love relationship when you're living together, and you can achieve many of those values, and that too counts as sanctity for their point of view. But everybody agrees that sexuality, everybody among the rabbis of North America agreed that sexuality should not be a matter of hooking up until there's more of a relationship of mutual responsibility, one to the other.
Yeah, I think towards the end of the book, you talk about, I think, some of the 20th century, Dr. Borowitz of blessed memory, and Rabbi Green and the Buber thing about talking about a sense of a sliding scale of standards. If I read that correctly. Would that be really what you're talking about now? Would that be correct?
In my judgment, yes. That would definitely be correct. I'm not sure if that's really achievable at the present time, the way in which sexual practices are among college-educated Americans. I don't think it's easy to move to that. But I think that to have the consciousness, the very first thing has to be, there has to be a sexual ethics. And we've certainly seen that with the emphasis on the Me Too movement. And the fact that when two people get together, very often there's an asymmetry of power. And it's not only in the situation of a boss and a person working for that boss, but it's also the case even within a marriage relationship that some persons right. are more needy than others. Some have more charisma. Some have more power. Some have greater weaknesses and vulnerabilities. We know how to push each other's buttons. And therefore, the structure of marriage does require a kind of an ethics. The origin of that ethics within the biblical tradition actually goes back to the book of Exodus, in which they're talking about an extremely asymmetrical relationship. The man who has two wives, he has polygamy, and he has the financial power, he has the legal power, but he has an obligation to both of his wives, even though his tendency is to care only about the second wife, who's younger and maybe more beautiful and newer and more exotic. They say, even for the first wife, you owe her basic needs, food, clothing, and sexual intimacy. And in the Middle Ages, Ramban, the 13th century Spaniard, understood it this way. He said, when you make love to your wife, whatever wife you have, even if it's one of many, you have to make sure that you've created a beautiful bedroom with beautiful bedding, and you have to treat her not like a prostitute that you would have sex on the floor, but like it's a beautiful image. So there's a dignity that you have to invest in. And he also said that it's important to have physical contact with that spouse, not only sexual contact, but physical contact, a hug, a kiss, a patting on the back. The wrong kind of sex is the sex of the Persian Zoroastrians, in which they would have sex only in full clothing. And therefore, in Jewish law, if the husband or the wife refused to take off their clothes in a marital situation, that's grounds for divorce, at least according to the followers of Rav, but not according to today's Hasidic followers of Kahana. It's a big source of debate. So it seems to me that there's a place for us to talk about that each one of us has needs, that we have an obligation to those needs, that part of those needs is dignity. Part of those needs is never, ever to use coercion, not just physical coercion. We have to, according to Maimonides, we have to woo our partner to make love every single time, as if it was the first time. It doesn't help that it says I'm married. It doesn't say, well, do I have to earn sexual contact every single time? And the rabbi's answer is absolutely. If your wife or the husband refuse again and again and again, all you have really is you have the power to say, let me try to woo again and woo the person again. And then if it doesn't work out, then you have the divorce possibility. So that's part of the sexual ethics we need to have to guarantee justice, because relationships are always asymmetrical one way or another, and we have to maintain at least that level of mutuality and mutual responsibility.
I wanted to ask you, picking up on some of the what you're alluding to, some of the work that we do in Jewish sacred aging obviously talks about, look, we're living longer and we're living healthier. So people in their 80s and 90s, and yes, chemistry has made Viagra or Cialis and whatever is possible. But there is a point sometimes where just the libido says, thank you very much. It's been a wonderful ride, but I'm married. I'm in this relationship. So could you talk to us a little bit about this idea of intimacy, which is a word that we, in some of our workshops, we talk about. It has not necessarily to do with actual intercourse, but in many ways sends just a powerful message, this concept of sexual intimacy, of the touching, the holding, of falling asleep, holding each other, of the, as we get older, how increasingly important this is, and does the tradition speak to that?
Right. I think tradition, that is, in the example I gave of Ramban, speaks to that the physical touch is essential for who we are. I think we learn it from babies who are in incubators for a long period of time, and there's the danger of death from failure to thrive because of lack of touching. I think certainly that part of intimacy, that for all human beings need that physical kind of intimacy. And in general, the whole notion of marriage, going back to the Garden of Eden, is it's not good for a human being to be alone. There's a sense in which not just dealing with our physical needs or our emotional needs, but the whole ideal is for two people who are different, not the same, different, to come together and to appreciate their interdependency. And that interdependency can be physical, it can be sexual, it can be in all kinds of ways that we have of helping one another and appreciating our difference because it's complementary. And I think that's probably the core notion that I get from the Bible, that our basic unit is not the individual. And autonomy and self-sufficiency is not the basic ideal. The ideal is to be dependent. Not to have a one-sided dependence, which is patriarchal and often abusive, but to have a two-sided dependence. And so to find many situations in which we can find that two-sidedness and therefore benefit from one another, I think that's the core of, and sexuality is only one apex, one high point in that relationship. What I do think rabbinic tradition offers is the importance of marital communion independent of the sexual issue. So let's go to the person you would least likely be expected to learn anything from about marriage, certainly for me and certainly for you. And that is to go to the most ultra-Orthodox rabbi you can think of, a man who lived 70 years ago, who was called the Chazon Ish, who was a Lithuanian head of the yeshiva. He himself had a terrible marriage. However, he is the first person within the ultra-Orthodox world to put out a flyer, a very short letter, to all of his yeshiva students, ultra-Orthodox, and to tell them that from now on we need to emphasize marital communication. Now, he's doing this because he's trying to fight against an opposite tendency within the Hasidic world. The opposite tendency coming out of Kahana, specifically of a Hasidic group called Gur, which had decided to teach and continues to teach to all of its followers, never use your spouse's first name. Never have a conversation in the bedroom. Minimize sex to once a month, maybe twice a month. Always check out any question you have about contact with your spouse with a special mashgiach, a religious supervisor, which is appointed for every single couple. Never walk together in the street. Never be together on an elevator. Never sit next to each other in a taxi or on an airplane. In fact, don't even have showers at home because that may lead to greater arousal. Instead, you should have your showers in public baths. In fact, they're not only denying sexual intimacy, even though you're married, they're denying any emotional intimacy. It's against that you began to have an internal revolt by this ultra-Orthodox rabbi who's anti-feminist, anti-Western, anti-Zionist, who's very strong on sexual segregation before marriage, but he says you should talk to your wife. Why? Because, and here is his prejudices about essentialism, men are different than women. In other words, he basically, long before the popular book, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus, he said, that's the case. We are come from different worlds. Only the men study Talmud. The women don't have that. So therefore, because you come from a different world, the only way you can come together and be one flesh, the only way the divine can come between you so it becomes a sacred connection, the only way you can make your spouse happy is if you find out from her what makes her or him happy. So suddenly, and he's the first one ever to say that conversation is absolutely essential for the overall emotional intimacy in a marriage. And his advice then began to be developed by many of their students. And if you'd like, I could read you one particularly interesting example of it. Is this a good time to do this?
Yeah, sure.
This is one of his students. It's already 50 years later. It's a book published in 2003. And these are already popular books aimed at ultra-Orthodox couples. And this is what he said. The Torah established that the only way for a person To be complete as a human being, not a mere half, is to be united as a man and a woman in marriage. The basic unit is not the individual and the individual's perfection. It's the coming together of the two different ones, man and woman. So during their whole lives, they live in mutuality. Each must learn about the other half. The result will be a whole human being, a person who has both a male and female perspective on the whole of creation. That's his ideal. It's not just to get along with your spouse. It's that your spouse has a worldview in every possible area, and only if you bring the complexity of those male and female aspects can you talk about fullness. But he wasn't a fool. He says, I know that's not what happens. So he says, however, what happens in reality is that instead of a man learning the female perspective, he insists stubbornly that he remain in his narrow male perspective even after marriage. And he misses the main purpose of marriage. As long as one has not emerged from the small viewpoint of one person, one is still in the beginning stages of marriage. That's why, he says, God gave you a spouse, so you have a private tutor in order to teach you to see the other side, the other half, and that's what makes the world worthy of becoming one. That was his idea. Now, I can't say that's what happens in every ultra-Orthodox couple, but the rhetoric has changed a great deal, even if the reality still is far behind.
We're speaking with Noam Sacks-Zion, the author of Sanctified Sex, the 2,000-year Jewish debate on marital intimacy, a book recently published by the Jewish Publication Society. Noam is a faculty member at the Sholem Hartman Institute in Israel. Noam is available, right? If a congregation or one of my colleagues or organization wants to bring you in via the great magic carpet Zoom, let's say, is there a website or is an email that somebody can reach out to you? What would that be?
It's just my email, and I've been doing it for the last couple of months and having a great pleasure in that. It's just noam.zion@gmail. Very simple.
Noam.zion@gmail. Right. Noam,
Richard, in our preparations, you asked me a question about the role of fantasy and eroticism, and I wanted
to address that
as well, if it's a good time.
I also, in your concept of that, though, we'll lead into the other. I do wanted to ask
you before
we start running out of time. You write in the book about the role of halacha, and I think you use the phrase, quote, as an advisory system, unquote. And in a recent podcast that you did on the book, you noticed that the halacha was law versus advice, as it is, I guess, as you write in the book, an advisory system. So could you talk about a little bit about that role of halacha, and then also, which would come to a surprise to probably many people in the pew, because in the book you discuss this, the role of a fantasy and eroticism, which to some say, well, that's the halacha would never allow that. But lo and behold, here we go. So go ahead.
I think the important thing is to understand that as halacha developed, there continued to be the realm of public law. For example, public laws that prevent abuse by a husband abusing his wife, or vice versa. And we continue to need public law in order to protect the weaker person in the relationship of marriage. But probably the largest halacha, especially in the Middle Ages, was with the shaping of an ideal personality. Working on your character traits, as Maimonides was concerned about, working on your humility, managing to control and to shape your libido and your instincts so you're not controlled by them in an irrational and an immoral way, and of achieving higher and higher levels of sanctity. Now, it's halacha. The halacha says you're supposed to do that. But of course, there's no way to enforce that. It's not a law, be holy, but rather it's an aspiration. And so the halacha has been concerned with giving you guidelines and habits that will allow you to reach higher and higher levels of sanctity, of unity, of love, of peace. Those are its highest goals. One of the amazing things for me is that there was one rabbi, again, living 70 years ago, a friend of that Chazon Ish, that very extreme Lithuanian rabbi. His name was Isaac Scher. And he wrote a long 30-page letter to all of his yeshiva students who were married. And it's like no other text I've ever read before. It's a text that he says should be read by every couple, both the man and the woman, once a month. His ideal was that every month after the period of separation caused by during the menstrual cycle, when the husband and wife come back together, they have to return to the honeymoon and become like a bride again and like a groom again. And that the ideal bride and groom, the first bride and groom, were Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. As we still say in the traditional blessings at a Jewish wedding, Re'im Ahuvim, the loving friends in the Garden of Eden. But he took it so seriously that he gave guided imagery exercises for the man and the woman. Imagine yourself, he says, in the Garden of Eden. Imagine yourself intoxicated by the smells of the Garden of Eden. Imagine that God was the person who was your party planner, the one who braided the wife's hair, the one who was the best man at the wedding. Imagine that the food is being brought to you. Use your imagination, and imagination became a positive term for him, and you will be intoxicated. You will be flying through the air, and as you develop this through foreplay, through conversation, at the highest moment of sexual coming together, then you will be totally in the highest space of that kind of spirituality. And he had a special technique. He said that at your wedding and during the whole week of your romance, it could be a much longer period of Western civilization, we write down all the compliments we gave to our spouse. Everything we thought about their physical beauty, and he wanted to describe it very physically. He's one of the first rabbis I have ever seen to quote the Song of Songs, the love songs of Solomon, not as an allegory about God, Israel, but literally as the love between a man and a woman. And so he says, you write down in your little notebook all of the compliments you gave to her and she gave to you. And of course, it doesn't have to be female from many of our perspectives, whoever the partners are. And you reread it every single month to get back into the mood. The key element, again, is not to take for granted that we're married and therefore we have sex. But rather, it's always wooing again and entering into that guided imagery again. I would say, okay, I think that's the key element. Now, for this rabbi, the love relationship between a man and a woman or between spouses that we have to work at is not only about the microcosm of marriage. It's in fact the first unit of the much lighter goal of tikkun olam, of repairing the world. If you can bring together two people who are very different, if you can bring together the physical and the spiritual, the erotic and the emotional at the small level, then you're contributing to the larger ideals of bringing peace and love and unity to the world. And that was their perspective.
Can you hear us soon on a variety of different levels? Noam, before we start running out of time, I want to ask you, and as I said at the beginning, to my colleagues out there, there's a wealth of material we've just touched the surface for you to deal with in this book, and it's a great teaching teaching manual. And again, to bring Noam to your congregation, Noam.Zion, Z-I-O-N, or Z if you're listening to us outside the U.S., at gmail.com. But there's one other particular thing I wanted to just ask you to riff on, because it's, again, to some people, the people in the pew, they may not see this. You write about Shabbat as a trigger for a revolutionary understanding of marital lovemaking.
Yes, very good.
The idea of Shabbat as this metaphor, as this very erotic and powerful, and you use the word revolutionary understanding. Talk to me about, unpack that for us a little bit.
Very good. So this is the question about the title of the book, Sanctified Sex. What does sanctity have to do with sex? So in the Bible and also in the Talmud, making love within marriage has nothing to do with sanctity. As long as it's legitimate, as long as you're having a relationship with somebody that's legal, then that's not about being sacred. That's just about pleasure. And Shabbat as a day of holiness in the Bible is a day that's defined by what you don't do. You don't work. But it never does it say that you do make love on Shabbat. It doesn't say anything about making love either way. And many, many people, sects in Judaism, like the Karaites, said you're forbidden to have sex on Shabbat because sex is about procreation, and creation is, of course, forbidden. Just like you're not allowed to plow your field, they say you're not allowed to plow your spouse to plant the seed. The rabbi's revolution was to say that Shabbat is not only about what you don't do, the pleasures of eating, of sleeping, and making love. And therefore, the rabbis made it easier to make love. And they said that even the scholar who's concerned with sanctity should be making love to his spouse on Shabbat. But that's pleasure. What happened in the Middle Ages, what happened in parts of Kabbalah, but not all of Kabbalah, is to say that Shabbat is about a marriage. It's a spiritual marriage and a physical marriage between the masculine aspects of God and the feminine aspects of God. And so every Friday night when you pick up your cup of wine, it's as if you're doing a wedding. And when you're singing songs, it's like you're the chorus who are celebrating a wedding with somebody. And in the middle of the night at 12 o'clock, when the mystic and his spouse would make love together, they would do it. And in their mind, they were bringing together the male and female aspects of God. Now, it's that notion that, in fact, bringing a couple together is an act on the earthly side, which is parallel to the heavenly, that really made it sacred. And that's why these later thinkers like Isaac Scher and the Chazon Ish can talk about bringing a couple together, in which sanctity is not about separation. Sanctity is about unifying and a unification of two disparate aspects that when they come together, they have a fuller unity. Maybe I'll end with the following image. One of my teachers, a man named Menachem Fruman, who was very known for living on the West Bank, but also, even though he was a religious Zionist who believed in Jewish settlement in the West Bank, he also believed that we should have dialogues with the most ultra-Orthodox Muslim authorities, the ones who supported Hamas, and he had those conversations. So a reporter showed up at his house, interviewed him about these dialogues with Muslim ulama, and then at the end, they said, do you mind if we take a photograph of you? He says, yes, but only under one condition. I want the photograph to be with my wife and I together. And he has a wonderful relationship with his wife. So there's his wife smiling. There's Menachem smiling. And he says to the cameraman, please focus the camera on the space between the two of us. Because when a husband and a wife are truly in love, then the Shekhinah, the divine presence, is between them. So take a photograph of God.
Oh, thank you very much. And I really appreciate that. Great image at the end, too. Noam Saks-Zion, the author of Sanctified Sex, the 2000-year Jewish debate on marital intimacy. Thank you very much, Noam. Stay safe. I'm glad you got that fourth booster or fourth shot. You were talking about it before we went on. Stay safe and healthy and Hatzlacha. I hope to see you in the United States, and I hope just continued great work. Thank you very much for this very, very interesting, exciting, and enlightening conversation, and just stay healthy. To all of you, thank you again for joining us on today's edition of Secrets of Meaning, the podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. Again, if you'd like to contact us, email me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. If you'd like to make a tax-free donation to help support these podcasts, go to the website, jewishsacredaging.com, scroll down to the conveniently located donate button, click on it, and just follow the prompts. Again, a big thank you and a shout out to our producer, Steve Lubetkin, because these podcasts are recorded and produced at the studios of Lubetkin Media Companies in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. To all of you, again, toda rabah, hatzlacha, refuah shleima, and we'll see you soon. Stay safe, stay well, everybody. Thank you.